Welcome to this edition of the Reading Muslims podcast, the special series on Fiqh and Qahwa with myself, Anbar Iman, and Muhammad Fadl. As indicated in our earlier edition of this podcast, Muhammad and I are having a conversation around the study of Islamic law. Islamic law, obviously, a source of interest within the academy, one that has a strong textual basis for many who study it, but also one that's increasingly subject to new modes of analysis and inquiry in a larger context of academic disciplinary development in the field of Islamic studies. On this edition of Fiqh and Qahwa, Muhammad and I are going to talk a little bit more about textuality, the who's, the hows, and the whats of the readings that we do. Welcome again, Muhammad. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Anbar.
So, Muhammad, as you know, Reading Muslim at the Institute of Islamic Studies, and it centers the question of textuality in the study of Islam. Muslims are both readers, but they're also read, for better or for worse. And so we have different hubs. Among the research hubs that we feature, though, one is called Reading Practices. Reading Practices interrogates the what's, how's, and the why's of reading. But as we've discovered, answering those questions also depends on who is doing the reading. So I'd like to turn our conversation to a few questions on this topic, though we'll narrow the focus to reflect on Islamic legal texts. And so my first question is really, again, is an extension of the conversation we had last time. Last time we talked a lot about your training in the doctoral program, but one of the things that you bring to the study of Islam is also a professional training as a lawyer. In my case, I did the JD before the PhD, so I had a different sequencing. And so with that, you have a unique ability to tell us about how the JD affects or changes or modifies your approach to Islamic legal studies, particularly in light of what you shared with us last time around your graduate training at the University of Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, as I was saying last time, I went through grad school basically clueless about what I wanted to study. It was a lot of fun because I took lots of stuff that was really interesting and cool, and I learned a lot, but it wasn't systematic. You know, if I had gone into my PhD program from day one, knowing that I wanted to do Islamic law, right, I would have had a very different graduate school experience and probably be a lot better scholar than I am now, because I would have been focused from day one on how to make myself the best Islamic law scholar. I would have, you know, focused on very specific texts, you know, had laser-like focus on mastering them, et cetera, right? But that's not the way it was. You know, I was 22 when I started. I didn't really know what I was doing. And it ended up working out okay. But what law school did for me was it gave me a kind of systematic conceptual architecture that I could then draw on in reading Islamic legal texts. Now, my work is almost, I would say, 75% focused on the technical minutiae of Islamic law, furu'. Most people don't really do furu' because, well, frankly, it's pretty damn boring. And it's very technical, and it's hard to get into without really understanding the technical vocabulary. And particularly if you're looking at post-classical jurisprudence with the mutun and the shuru', there's a highly structured technical vocabulary particular to every madhab. So you just can't pick the book up and start reading it. So in this way, the post-classical tradition is much more, what I would say, professional than the early tradition. The early tradition in many ways is a lot more accessible because it hasn't been formalized in this kind of systematic way. Looking at 14th, 15th century texts, the authors are dealing with very, very small issues, right? You know, relative to the big scheme of the legal system. And they're speaking exclusively to their own colleagues within their own doctrine. So there's a lot that they don't have to say. And so it makes it relatively opaque for an outsider to come in and figure out what's going on. And there's got to be a huge upfront investment to be able to decode these texts in a way that you can find, you can trace interesting developments in them. Right. And so law school made it a lot easier for me to recognize what are really interesting issues at least from a lawyer's perspective. Maybe not interesting from, you know, a historian's perspective or something like that, but from a lawyer's perspective, interesting issues, right? So that gave me a lot better, what I would say, it expanded my conceptual toolbox. So I have now more things that I can ask my texts and extract from them interesting things to talk about.
I ask a follow-up then, because what's, you know, you and I have had conversations around the importance of theoretical framings as well. And you yourself writing in conversation with Rawls, for instance, as a theoretical perspective that you bring to your work. Now, when you talk about law school as a kind of disciplinary entry point, is that the theory that you're talking about when you and I talk about the importance of theory, or are you distinguishing those two things?
I'm a theoretical pluralist. I don't believe there's one right way of reading things. I think there are potentially infinite ways of reading something, as long as one is being faithful to the raw materials that one is reading. I think law and economics is an interesting way of analyzing certain topics in Islamic law. I've done it in some cases. In other situations, you know, a more sort of private law deontic commitment can be used. I'm not really committed to anything as the true way of reading. What I think is useful, though, is to have an idea of larger questions in jurisprudence, right? And then you can read the body of doctrine from that perspective, which, you know, as a NELC student, NELC is excellent in terms of philological training. It's very bad in giving a conceptual approach to the material. So somebody in my program who just does Arabic, they can pick up a fiqh book and they might not be sensitive to the distinctions between categories like fasid and batil and lazim and jaiz and sahih and thabit and all these other sorts of things. Because in some broad sense, many of these terms seem to be synonyms. And so they might not understand that there's an important technical difference in these judgments. And they might not have a theoretical framework for trying to understand, well, how do we abstract from this list of particulars and propose a general framework for organizing the solutions proposed to this problem? And so that's where studying, going to law school, gives one theoretical power. Basically, it gives you theoretical power of abstraction that you're not going to get if you just go through NELC and then start reading fiqh books.
Well, I want to push you on something because, you know, earlier you said that, you know, you study a lot of furu', and frankly, I think you even called it boring. It's very technical. And I understand that. But I wonder if you're also underestimating the genre, because there is a lot of work on usul al-fiqh, as you know. But yes, you're right about fiqh is an area that you've taken a very specific interest in. But I'm wondering if it's precisely because you're trained as a lawyer that fiqh is not boring, but is in fact rich in a way that might not be as evident to those without that legal training. I don't want to make a controversial statement here about colleagues who don't have a legal training working on fiqh, but I'm wondering if for you, it would be fair to say it isn't really boring at all. It's actually part and parcel of the kind of training you've already had.
Well, it's not boring for me, obviously, or else I wouldn't be doing this for this many years. My point is that if you've spent most of your time, studying literature, anthropology, sociology, history, picking up a fiqh book, post-classical fiqh book from, like, say, the 14th century, is a sure way to relieve insomnia. Because the arguments really seem unbelievably tedious unless you have a broader theoretical perspective and understand what's at stake and what's going on. Now, it's very difficult to understand what's at stake if you haven't been trained in law. And so that's why what I would say is it's boring because it's opaque, to non-specialists. That's the problem. I mean, I think one of the reasons why Orientalists dismiss post-classical literature is precisely because you really need to make a substantial upfront investment in order to be able to find it engaging. And honestly, you know, reading early histories and chronicles and stuff like that, it's a lot more lively. There's characters, there's personalities, there's intrigue, right? And that's not there in 14th century fiqh books. Even reading early fiqh works like Malik and Shaybani, it's a lot more lively. I don't know what I can say, because it's dialogic. You know, there are sometimes, you know, real incidents at play, names, you know, things you can relate to. But in the 14th century, it's become completely abstracted and scientific.
So let me ask you, I want to move on to our next question. It's related, but it kind of takes us in a slightly different direction. But it's still connected to the who of who's doing the reading. So I want to abstract from the specificities of your training as a lawyer, coming to fiqh sources. But I want to think about my colleagues in anthropology of Islam, for instance, who and we've had conversations around this, you and I, and myself and them as well, is that if you read anthropology of Islam literature, there's a strong sense in which the researcher is very present in the study. In fact, oftentimes identifies themselves, positions themselves. And so it's the conversation around positionality that I want us to think about. And when you read Islamic law literature, there's almost a kind of positivist sensibility separate and distinct from the researcher, him or herself. And I guess my question is what is the role of positionality for the field of Islamic studies? We don't really see it robustly as a feature in that field. We see feminist approaches to Islamic law, and increasingly we see critical race approaches to Islamic law. And those are certainly important interventions, but they're not quite the same as thinking about positionality. And in a recent blog or a recent interview at Harvard, Wael Hallaq seemed to suggest that Islamic law might benefit from a greater attention to positionality as it has informed the study of Islamic law. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts about this conversation that's happening in anthropology, that's been part of anthropology, is eking its way into Islamic law or legal studies. But nonetheless, has yet to find a steady home.
Okay. I think it's a really important question. And I would say that I've got three different things that I want to say. I want to first talk about Professor Hallaq's blog post. I think there's a difference between committed scholarship and positionality that you're describing. I would say that from the moment I went to grad school, I've always been a committed scholar. Committed in the following sense is that I grew up as an Arab, as a Muslim, in the United States. My family immigrated here in 1970. You know, just to put it mildly, the public messaging around who I was not very reinforcing of my dignity. And so I always viewed my scholarship from the perspective of reclaiming something that people said I wasn't really entitled to. Okay? So I resented, I'll be honest, I resented the way Orientalists described Islamic law, because not only was it personally injurious to me, but it also seemed to make no sense logically. Like, why would a society invest so many resources in a certain activity if it has nothing to do with the way they govern themselves? Because governance is an essential part of any human community. And so not only was it insulting, it seemed completely preposterous on its face, but yet that seemed to be the accepted notion, right? So I've always viewed myself as a committed scholar in that sense, in that I view my scholarship as a way of reclaiming my own dignity and dignity of people like me. So that's I want to be very clear about that. And I applaud Professor Hallaq for that stance, right? Now, as between anthropologists and people who study Islamic law, like I said, I'm a methodological pluralist. I don't say that one is right and one is wrong. I just think that everybody has to know the limitations of his or her approach. Mm-hmm. So I concluded my previous remarks to your previous question about the idea of post-classical jurisprudence. One of the reasons why it's boring and hard and opaque and difficult for people to access is because it takes on a kind of scientific character, right? Now, what I mean by taking on a scientific character is that it strives from its own perspective, use Hart's term, from the internal point of view, it strives to be an internally coherent objective object of study. Okay. Now, you don't have to accept that argument. You can say that it fails or do all sorts of other things. But the point is, from the internal point of view, right, the faqih who was writing these texts believes it to be a rationally coherent object of scientific study and presents it in that sort of way. The anthropologist of Islamic law has a completely different approach to it. He or she wants to see how the system of rules is embodied in the practices of a particular society, right? Now, this is also a terribly important way of studying law.
Yeah.
But it's different. But it's not only just different, right? It requires the first.
It does.
Because if you want to do an anthropology of Islamic law, you have to have a theoretical conception of what Islamic law is. Right? And so the only way we can define the domain of what a proper anthropology of Islamic law is, or a proper sociology of Islamic law is, requires us to have a theoretical conception of what Islamic law is, right? And so that was actually one of the things that I tried to do in my dissertation, is try to make an argument about where should we look for delimiting what Islamic law as a theoretical body, as a theoretical science is, right? And, you know, that I'm open, you know, I think it can be contested, but I try to make an argument. These are certain, it's a certain textual tradition. It's circumscribed, right? And this is where you find the law, right?
Yeah.
It's not in sort of these other things.
Yeah.
And so if we want to talk about a sociology of Islamic law, or we want to talk about an anthropology of Islamic law, we have to begin with knowing, you know, what the theoretical, where the theoretical law resides, right?
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, I'm perfectly happy to hear, you know, critical race approaches to it, a feminist approach to it, a Marxist approach to it. But we have to agree on what the law is, right?
Yeah.
If we can't agree on what the law is, then we can't do any of those other things.
Very well said. I want to, Muhammad, thank you for that. That was a really helpful explanation around issues of positionality. I want to conclude this session of Fiqh and Qahwa and welcome you to our next one, where we will discuss the issue of what, when we think about the very things that Muhammad was talking about, reflecting on this internal perspective of law and what that implies about the genre of text and the kinds of text that we're thinking of. Thank you very much for joining us today.